Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show that extracts the most important nuggets of knowledge to help you stay well-informed, with just enough humor to keep you hooked. Today, we're diving headfirst into the fascinating and often, let's be honest, incredibly complex world of insurance brokerage. Our focus, a company you might not instantly recognize by name, but one that has written a really remarkable story of consistent growth, Brown & Brown, Inc. Now, Brown & Brown isn't just any company, it's an S&P 500 dividend aristocrat, a business basically synonymous with consistent, disciplined growth for decades. But suddenly, the industry is buzzing about a bet so enormous it's making waves across the entire market. What prompted this monumental shift, and how could it fundamentally redefine their future trajectory in a way we maybe might not expect? So our core question today really is, how does a company built on steady, strategic expansion suddenly make its single most ambitious move ever? A move that could redefine its entire future.
That's precisely our mission in this deep dive. We're going to peel back the layers of the investment analyses, really unpack the strategic thinking behind their recent and truly monumental acquisition. And we want to get to grips with the intricate market dynamics at play here. We'll assess the significant risks, sure, but also the colossal opportunities this transformative deal presents for Brown & Brown. Ultimately, we want to understand not just the what and the why, but most importantly, what this all means for you as someone trying to understand a complex and evolving business landscape. This isn't just about facts, it's about the strategic implications and, you know, the surprising elements may be lurking beneath the surface.
Okay, let's unpack this right from the start. Because when most of us think of insurance, our minds often jump straight to the massive companies that actually underwrite policies. You know, the ones taking on the risk of your house burning down or your car getting into an accident. But Brown & Brown carved out its niche by doing something fundamentally different, right? They're not underwriting. They're in the business of connection and expertise. Let's really break down that core model because it's the foundation for everything else we'll discuss.
Exactly. Brown & Brown operates what we call a capital-light intermediary business model. And this is a crucial distinction, really key to their success. They do not, under any circumstances, assume underwriting risk. That's not their game. Their role is to act as a broker and agent, connecting clients, whether those are individuals, small businesses, or massive global corporations, with the insurance carriers that actually underwrite the policies. It's a service-oriented model. And it generates incredibly predictable, recurring, fee-based revenue. Think of them as the expert guides navigating a complex insurance jungle for you. Their revenue streams primarily consist of commissions, which are typically a percentage of the insurance premiums clients pay, and also fees for highly specialized services. These services can range from claims administration, where they actually manage the process for clients.
Right, handling the paperwork and the process.
Exactly. All the way to comprehensive risk management consulting, helping businesses identify and mitigate potential threats before they happen. And because insurance policies are generally renewed annually, this model provides a really stable foundation for consistent financial performance. Plus, a critical aspect of this stability is their remarkably high client retention rates. That speaks volumes about the value they provide. Yeah. You know?
So it really is about providing expert risk management solutions and guidance.
Yeah.
That's a powerful dual value proposition. But for a listener, it kind of begs the question, how do they maintain that balance without a perceived conflict of interest, especially when negotiating with carriers on behalf of clients? It seems like they're serving two masters, you know, in a good way, but that must come with unique tensions, right?
Yeah. That's a perceptive question, and it really goes to the heart of what makes a successful broker work. The balance is maintained through, well, transparency, trust, and ultimately by demonstrating superior value to both sides. For clients, Brown & Brown leverages its deep industry expertise, its sheer scale, and its extensive relationships with a wide array of insurance carriers. This allows them to negotiate more favorable policy terms and pricing.
Getting better deals, essentially.
Better deals and, critically, access to specialized knowledge and programs that clients might not be able to find on their own. We're talking about really niche areas like healthcare, specific tribal nations, private equity firms, or even, say, aviation insurance, highly specialized fields where their expertise is invaluable. For the insurance carriers, Brown & Brown acts as a vital distribution channel. It gives them efficient access to a broad and highly diversified pool of customers, saving the carriers significant marketing and sales costs. The tension you mentioned is mitigated because both parties recognize the broker's role in facilitating an efficient, well-informed market. Brown & Brown isn't trying to squeeze one side for the benefit of the other. They're trying to find the optimal match.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Brown & Brown is huge, right?
Yes.
A global player by any measure. Yet they've maintained this distinctive decentralized operational model. On the surface, that sounds almost contradictory for a company of its scale. What does that actually look like on the ground? And what unexpected advantages or maybe even unique complexities does that structure present in their day-to-day operations? I mean, many companies attempt decentralization, but few manage it at Brown and Brown scale without just fragmenting. What's the secret ingredient in the power of WE that makes it more than just a slogan? How does it let them attract talent and integrate firms, especially when those firms might have their own distinct cultural DNA?
It is indeed a fascinating, almost paradoxical aspect of their structure, and you've absolutely hit on the core of their operational magic. Brown & Brown is organized as what they describe as a meritocracy of entrepreneurial, locally managed profit centers. So what this means is that leaders of individual offices or teams are empowered with significant operational autonomy, real autonomy. They're given the responsibility and, importantly, the accountability for their own profit and loss statements, their own P&L.
So real ownership.
Exactly. It's not just delegating tasks, it's delegating ownership. This approach, instead of some rigid top-down command structure, fosters a highly competitive entrepreneurial culture within the organization. The secret ingredient, if you want to call it that, lies in a combination of carefully structured incentives, really robust internal communication, and a clear understanding of boundaries. Local leaders get rewarded for growth and profitability, but also for collaborating and leveraging the broader firm's resources. And the benefits are manifold. It attracts and retains top talent people who thrive in an environment where they have agency and can truly build their own local business. It allows them to maintain incredibly deep local client relationships, which is just vital in a relationship-driven business like insurance. And it ensures the entire organization remains nimble and responsive to very specific local market conditions despite its global footprint. They have this internal mantra, the power of WE, which really encapsulates how they balance that local autonomy with crucial centralized support.
Okay, so it's not just talk.
No, it isn't just vague encouragement. It means centralized financial discipline, strategic oversight, and access to national resources like cutting-edge technology platforms, compliance expertise, or specialized carrier relationships that a small local shop could never access on its own. For instance, a local office might identify a unique risk for a client, but it's the power of the larger Brown & Brown network that connects them to that maybe obscure carrier able to underwrite it.
Right. While the benefits are clear, for an outside observer, maintaining such local autonomy within a global giant might seem prone to inconsistencies.
Yeah.
Or maybe even counterproductive internal competition. How does Brown & Brown guard against those downsides and make sure that local empowerment truly reinforces the power of WE rather than, you know, creating silos or a fragmented client experience?
That's the tightrope walk, definitely. And it's a critical point. They guard against fragmentation primarily through their robust financial reporting and accountability structure, but also, very importantly, through cultural reinforcement. Each profit center is accountable for its P&L, yes, but the corporate leadership sets clear strategic guidelines and performance metrics that actively encourage collaboration and cross-selling across different offices and segments. The power of WE is actively cultivated through internal communication, recognition programs, even an internal referral system that ensures local offices are incentivized to pass business to specialized segments or other regions when it best serves the client.
So there's a mechanism for sharing.
Exactly. It's a delicate balance, for sure. But their long track record suggests they've found a highly effective formula.
And that track record includes their status as an S&P 500 dividend aristocrat. Having increased dividends for, what, an impressive 31 consecutive years? How has this unique decentralized model directly contributed to that kind of sustained, consistent success?
Oh, this decentralized entrepreneurial model is arguably the bedrock of their long-term success and that dividend consistency. It's directly contributed to consistent, strong, and profitable growth over many, many years. Because local teams are incentivized and empowered, they drive really high client retention rates. We're talking significantly above the industry average, often in the mid-90% range, compared to an industry average maybe around 84%.
Wow, that's a big difference.
It is. And this stable, recurring client base is invaluable. Moreover, this very model makes them an incredibly attractive home for acquired firms. When Brown & Brown acquires a smaller brokerage, those local entrepreneurial leaders often want to maintain some degree of autonomy and control, right? And Brown & Brown's model allows for that. It helps preserve the entrepreneurial spirit and, crucially, the client relationships of those targets. This disciplined acquisition strategy, combined with their organic growth, has fueled their remarkable run, culminating in that Dividend Aristocrat status. It's really a testament to sustained profitability, prodigious cash generation, and a highly effective operational philosophy.
Okay, now let's talk about the elephant in the room. Or maybe, given the size, the colossal blue whale. Brown & Brown has built its legacy on consistent, disciplined, often smaller acquisitions.
Tuck-ins.
Right. But in mid-2025, they made a move that absolutely dwarfed anything it had done before. What happened? And what's the sheer scale of this unprecedented deal that has everyone talking?
You're right, it truly is a whale of a deal. A paradigm shift for Brown & Brown, no question. On August 1st, 2025, Brown & Brown completed its most ambitious acquisition to date, the $9.825 billion purchase of Accession Risk Management Group. Accession itself is a massive player in the specialty insurance market, and this transaction is truly transformative for Brown & Brown.
Transformative. Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't just add to their capabilities, it dramatically scales them, particularly in those high-margin specialty lines we were just discussing. This effectively repositions Brown & Brown to compete more directly with the absolute largest top-tier players in the industry. It fundamentally alters their competitive landscape. To give you a sense of scale, this acquisition alone adds approximately $1.7 billion in pro forma annual revenue and over 5,000 employees to Brown & Brown's already significant operations.
5,000 people, just like that.
Just like that. It's a leap, not just a step.
Okay, so this isn't just a big deal. It's being called a strategic inflection point for the company. What's the potential upside here? Why is this acquisition so absolutely critical to Brown & Brown's future trajectory?
Well, what's fascinating here is that this isn't just about getting bigger for the sake of getting bigger. It's about strategically enhancing their market position, particularly in the most attractive and growing parts of the insurance market. The potential upside includes significantly enhanced growth, a much stronger competitive footing, and ultimately greater shareholder value. Specifically, by deepening their presence in those high-growth, high-margin specialty insurance markets.
Right, the really profitable niches.
Exactly. And it's worth noting that Brown & Brown's divestiture of certain third-party administrator, or TPA, businesses the ones handling claims and admin services back in late 2023, well, that can now be clearly seen as a preparatory step for this massive move.
Clearing the decks.
Precisely. It was about streamlining their focus and clearing the decks before taking on this monumental integration. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Accession itself was not a single entity. It was built through over 190 previous acquisitions.
Whoa, 190.
Yeah, over 190. So this means Brown & Brown isn't just acquiring one company. They're essentially integrating a whole constellation of businesses, each with their own histories, cultures, and operational complexities. This makes the integration into Brown & Brown's famously decentralized model a formidable operational and cultural undertaking. It will absolutely be the ultimate test of Brown & Brown's proven, but never before scaled to this degree, integration capabilities. The stakes really couldn't be higher for what they call the power of WE.
So while this is a huge opportunity to leapfrog ahead, it clearly comes with considerable challenges and risks. You just mentioned that Accession itself was a roll-up of over 190 firms. Is Brown & Brown effectively integrating another roll-up machine? And does that create a new layer of complexity or maybe even strategic debt that will need careful unwinding over time? What are the primary concerns or hurdles we should be aware of with a deal of this magnitude?
That raises a really important question about execution, and you're absolutely right to point out the meta-acquisition aspect. Integrating a company that is itself a product of hundreds of integrations adds exponential layers of complexity. It's not just about merging two corporate cultures, but potentially dozens or even hundreds of subcultures, each maybe with its own legacy systems and client relationships.
A real tangle.
Could be. The primary challenge, hands down, is flawlessly integrating Accession without diluting Brown & Brown's unique entrepreneurial culture or creating significant operational friction. Brown & Brown's management has always stressed cultural fit as their primary M&A criterion. That principle will now face its most rigorous test with such a massive influx of new professionals and the inherent complexities of Accession's own genesis. And beyond the internal integration, they also have to navigate concurrent market challenges. The insurance pricing cycle is complex right now. We're seeing softening commercial property rates, which are creating headwinds for organic growth.
Making it harder to grow naturally.
Exactly. And this is happening even as casualty lines like commercial auto and general liability continue to harden, providing only a partial offset. So they're making this enormous strategic pivot into a dynamic and sometimes challenging market, which just amplifies the execution risk.
Right. So the Accession deal isn't just a bolt-on. It's fundamentally reshaping Brown & Brown's very architecture.
Yeah.
How are they reorganizing their internal segments to accommodate this colossal new piece? And what does this new structure tell us about where they're placing their biggest bets going forward? They've been evolving their segments quite a bit recently, haven't
They certainly have, yes. And the evolution of their segment structure is a very clear indicator of their strategic direction. Back in the fourth quarter 2023, the company announced a realignment from four segments down to three, which became effective at the start of 2024. As we discussed, this involved divesting some of their TPA businesses from what was previously their services segment, essentially streamlining their focus. Now, looking ahead, post-Accession, we'll see another significant evolution. Their current programs and wholesale brokerage segments are slated to combine into a new, formidable specialty distribution segment. This new segment will be the powerhouse for integrating Accession's large-scale specialty platforms, things like risk strategies and 180 intermediaries.
So putting all the high-end stuff together.
Exactly. It's truly cementing Brown and Brown's focus on those high-growth, high-margin areas. It's a strategic move to create a unified, scaled entity for their most specialized offerings.
Got it. Okay, let's start with their largest segment, retail. What exactly does it cover, and how has it been performing in this evolving market, especially with some of those rate pressures you mentioned?
Right. The retail segment is their direct-to-customer arm. It provides a comprehensive suite of insurance products and services directly to end customers. This includes property and casualty, or P&C, insurance covering everything from buildings to business liability, along with employee benefits consulting and brokerage, and personal lines for individuals, like home and auto. Their client base is incredibly diverse, ranging from small and medium-sized enterprises, SMEs, all the way up to large, complex corporations and public institutions. Looking at their Q2 2025 data, the retail segment reported $697 million in revenue. That was a healthy 7.9% year-over-year growth.
Okay, not bad.
Not bad total growth, but its organic revenue growth, which strips out the impact of acquisitions, was 3.0%.
Ah, only 3%.
Yeah, and this figure was actually below expectations. It's a clear signal of that rate pressure we've seen in the commercial property market hitting them. It shows that even in their largest segment, they're feeling the effects of the broader insurance cycle.
Okay, this next segment, programs. That sounds really specialized. What makes it such a key driver of organic growth for Brown and Brown? How does it consistently outperform?
Yeah, the program segment operates as a managing general agent, or MGA. This means they actually develop and administer highly specialized insurance programs on behalf of carrier partners. These programs are tailored for very specific industries, think healthcare professionals, lawyers, or for affinity groups that share homogeneous risk profiles, like niche professional associations.
So they're building custom insurance products, basically.
In essence, yes. It's a high-value niche area where deep expertise is paramount. It allows them to create and manage bespoke insurance products. And this segment has been an exceptional performer for them, particularly in terms of organic growth. For the full year 2024, it posted an incredible 22.4% organic growth rate.
32%.
Yeah, really strong. In Q2 2025, revenues for programs were $381 million, showing a 5.9% total increase and 4.6% organic growth. Still remarkably robust, especially compared to retail, despite the broader market shifts. It just shows the power of deep specialization.
Okay, then there's the wholesale brokerage segment. You described it as an intermediary. That's an interesting concept. If the standard insurance market is like a finely paved highway, the excess and surplus or E&S market sounds like the wild, untamed backcountry where all the really unique and challenging risks venture. Can you paint a vivid, maybe even slightly quirky example of a unique risk Brown & Brown's wholesale brokerage segment might find cover for in that E&S space? Something really out there.
Ah, that's a fantastic analogy. And you're exactly right. The E&S market is where the standard carriers, the ones on the paved highway, won't go or often can't go because the risk is too unusual, too complex, or maybe just too new. The wholesale brokerage segment indeed serves as an intermediary to other intermediaries. It connects retail agents, both Brown and Brown's own and third-party agencies, with insurance carriers that specialize in these E&S lines. As for a quirky example, okay, imagine a company that specializes in ensuring, say, drone light shows for major stadium events. Huge choreographed swarms of drones.
Like for the Olympics or big concerts.
Exactly. Now, this isn't your average property or liability risk. It involves aviation liability, potentially complex cybersecurity for controlling that drone swarm, public liability if something goes wrong and drones crash.
Yeah, lots of things could go wrong there.
For sure. And unique property coverage for thousands of highly specialized, expensive drones. A standard carrier would likely just balk at that. Too weird, too many unknowns. Brown & Brown's wholesale brokerage team would take that unique exposure, leverage their deep relationships with E&S carriers who thrive on these complex, non-standard risks, and find a tailored solution. This segment accounted for about 13% of Brown & Brown's total revenue in 2024. For Q2 2025, it grew revenue by 14.6% to $182 million, with 3.9% organic growth. It's where the truly specialized bespoke solutions are forged.
Fascinating. So with the Accession deal now complete, these last two segments, programs and wholesale brokerage, are essentially merging into this new specialty distribution powerhouse. What's the strategic intent behind creating this combined, truly formidable segment, and what does it signal for Brown & Brown's positioning in the overall market?
The strategic intent is crystal clear, and it's incredibly ambitious. It reinforces Brown & Brown's deep commitment to expanding its leadership in those high-growth, high-margin specialty insurance markets. That's the focus. By combining these existing, strong segments with Accession's considerable platforms like Risk Strategies and 180 Intermediaries, they are creating an even more formidable force in the market.
A real heavyweight.
Absolutely. It's about leveraging truly massive scale and unparalleled specialized expertise to capture a larger share of the most profitable and complex areas of the insurance industry. This new specialty distribution segment isn't just a reshuffling of deck chairs, it's a statement. It signals their intention to be a dominant go-to player for any highly specialized insurance need. Ultimately, they're aiming for enhanced competitive advantage and accelerated growth at the very top tier of the industry.
Okay, let's zoom out a bit from Brown & Brown specifically. What does the overall global insurance brokerage industry actually look like? How big is this market we're talking about? And what are the sort of tectonic plates shifting beneath it that are driving its evolution?
Right. If we look at the broader landscape, the global insurance brokerage industry is a large, incredibly resilient, and continuously growing market. Now, exact market size estimates for 2024 can vary a bit between research firms. You see ranges anywhere from approximately $115 million up to maybe $314 million.
Quite a range.
It is. Depends on definitions. But the consensus forecast points to a compound annual growth rate, a CAGR, in the high seven digits over the next decade. So solid growth. North America, as you might expect, stands as the largest and most mature market, accounting for over one-third of global industry revenues. It's really a foundational sector that underpins almost all economic activity. And several powerful secular trends are driving this growth. We're seeing an increase in complexity of global risks. I mean, everything from sophisticated cybersecurity threats,
which are everywhere now.
Everywhere. And the escalating impacts of climate change, geopolitical instability, intricate global supply chain vulnerabilities, all demand specialized coverage. This complexity heightens the need for the sophisticated advice and tailored solutions that brokers provide. It's no longer just a simple transaction. Moreover, the non-discretionary nature of most insurance products ensures a durable demand base. People have to have it, which tends to be resilient across various economic cycles. Digitalization is also a key driver. Brokers are leveraging advanced technology and data analytics to enhance client service, improve operational efficiency, and offer more personalized, maybe even predictive insurance solutions, moving beyond just reactive coverage.
That makes sense. Is this market homogenous, though? Or are there different segments within it that operate differently, maybe with varying growth trajectories?
Oh, it's definitely not homogenous. The market is broadly segmented into what we call retail brokerage, which directly serves end customers like individuals and businesses, and wholesale brokerage, which provides specialized market access for other retail brokers, almost like a broker for brokers, as you said earlier.
Right.
What's particularly interesting is that while retail brokerage still constitutes the largest portion, the wholesale segment is experiencing accelerated growth. That's largely driven by the expansion of the excess and surplus, or E&S, lines market. That's where those complex, unusual, and unique risks get placed. And across both segments, property and casualty, or P&C, brokerage represents the dominant share of market. That just reflects the fundamental need to protect physical and financial assets.
Okay. It sounds like a really dynamic market. And one of the biggest forces at play, which we've touched on already, is consolidation, M&A. Why is merger and acquisition activity so robust here? Almost relentlessly so. And what does this frantic pace of M&A activity mean for a company like Brown & Brown that's historically been a consolidator but now just made the biggest move of its life?
Yeah, it's a defining characteristic of the industry, and it's almost a self-reinforcing cycle. The insurance brokerage landscape is inherently highly fragmented, just tons of smaller independent players out there. And this fragmentation has fueled a powerful and sustained trend of industry consolidation. M&A activity is robust and continuous. It's driven both by large strategic acquirers like Brown & Brown and significantly by a massive influx of capital from private equity firms. PE is huge in this space.
Right. PE loves these recurring revenue models.
Absolutely. 2024, for instance, saw near-record transaction volumes, including several blockbuster mega deals that have really reshaped the top tier of the industry. Private equity firms, in particular, have become a dominant force. They acquire brokerage platforms and then finance these aggressive roll-up strategies, continuously buying smaller firms to create scale and efficiency before, typically, selling them for a higher multiple. This creates a highly competitive M&A environment and naturally drives up valuation multiples, makes deals more expensive.
A feeding frenzy, almost.
You could say that sometimes. The strategic rationale for all this consolidation is compelling, though. Acquirers are looking to gain scale, which gives them greater leverage with insurance carriers and a broader array of solutions for clients. They want to enhance operational efficiency through shared services and technology, expand their geographic footprint, and broaden their portfolio of specialized services. It's really a race for market share, efficiency, and the ability to offer comprehensive solutions in an increasingly complex world.
How is this intense M&A activity actually shaping the market structure? Are we seeing a few giants emerge and dominate? Or is it creating a more complex landscape that pushes certain players into difficult strategic positions?
It's creating a distinctly bifurcated or barbell market structure, which is fascinating to observe. At one end, you have a small number of truly global mega brokers, you know the names, Marsh McLennan, Aon, Arthur J. Gallagher, that are cementing their dominance through these large-scale acquisitions. They offer unparalleled global reach and comprehensive solutions. At the other end, small, highly specialized boutique firms can still thrive by focusing on very specific niche markets where deep expertise and personalized service are often more valuable than sheer scale.
So bigger niche.
Pretty much. And this dynamic places immense strategic pressure on mid-sized firms. They often lack both the colossal scale of the giants and the laser-focused specialization of the boutiques.
Stuck in the middle.
Exactly, which makes them prime targets for acquisition. Now, Brown & Brown's strategy, if you look at it closely, is a direct product of this industry structure. Their historical focus on what they call tuck-in acquisitions typically targeted these pressured mid-sized firms. And their recent transformative acquisition of Accession is a clear, unambiguous move to ascend into that top tier of global consolidators, shifting their weight more towards the mega broker end of the barbell.
Okay, so given all this consolidation and intense competition, where does Brown & Brown stand in this landscape? What gives them their unique edge, their moat, if you will, that protects their business? And maybe more importantly now, as they scale up so dramatically, are they at risk of losing some of that nimbleness or local client intimacy that defined their original success? Could that erode the very qualities that built their moat?
That's a great question. Brown & Brown is certainly a formidable competitor. They are consistently ranked among the top 10 largest insurance brokers in the world, typically coming in at 6th or 7th globally based on recent revenue figures. However, it's important to acknowledge that the industry remains quite top-heavy. The big three, Marsh McLennan, Aon, and Arthur J. Gallagher & Co., are significantly larger. Just for context, an analysis from May 2024 estimated Brown & Brown's share of the large-cap public broker market at about 7.1%. Compare that to Marsh McLennan's 38.3%, Aon's 22.3%, and Arthur J. Gallagher's 16.6%.
Okay, so still a gap to the very top.
A significant gap, yes. They are punching above their weight for sure, but the competitive landscape is still dominated by giants. Despite this, their competitive moat is built on several robust pillars. First, scale and carrier relationships. Their significant premium volume provides them with negotiating leverage and preferential access to capacity from insurance carriers. That means getting better terms for clients. Second, specialization and expertise. Their deep knowledge in niche areas, particularly through their programs and wholesale segments, soon to be specialty distribution, creates a strong competitive advantage and often commands higher margins. Third, client relationships and switching costs. This is a trust-based business, right? And high client retention rates are a hallmark of top brokers. Brown & Brown consistently reports retention in the mid-90% range, way above the industry average.
That stickiness is key.
Absolutely. These sticky relationships create significant switching costs for clients because of the broker's deep institutional knowledge of their business and just the operational complexity of moving comprehensive insurance programs. And finally, their culture and human capital. Brown & Brown's unique decentralized and entrepreneurial culture is a powerful tool for attracting and retaining high-performing brokers. And it's a key selling point for acquisition targets who want to maintain a degree of autonomy within a larger organization. Now, to your excellent point about potentially losing nimbleness, that's precisely the strategic tension inherent in this massive accession deal. It's the big question. As Brown & Brown scales up so dramatically, the risk of diluting that local client intimacy and entrepreneurial agility is very real. Their decentralized model is designed to mitigate this, sure.
But integrating 5,000 people at once.
Exactly. Integrating 5,000 new employees from a single acquisition is a totally different animal than bringing in 30 smaller tuck-ins over a year. Management has to be incredibly disciplined in preserving that culture, ensuring that local leaders still feel empowered and connected, not just absorbed into some vast corporate machine. The success of the accession integration will largely hinge on whether they can achieve massive scale without compromising the very cultural strengths that built their moat in the first place. It's a huge challenge.
Okay, all this strategic maneuvering, all the talk of moats and market shifts, It ultimately comes down to the bottom line. Right, the numbers. So let's pull back the curtain on Brown and Brown's financial engine. Has it been as robust and consistent as their strategic ambitions suggest? And what did the numbers tell us about the health of the company before the accession deal fundamentally reshapes its balance sheet?
Right, let's get under the hood. Looking at Brown and Brown's financial performance over the past 5 years, it reveals a really impressive and powerful track record of profitable growth. No question. This is a direct result of their successful execution of that dual-pronged strategy we talked about, organic expansion and strategic acquisitions. Specifically, their total revenues grew from $2.39 billion back in 2019 to a robust $4.81 billion in 2024.
Doubled in 5 years, basically.
Pretty much. That translates to a compound annual growth rate, a CAG, of 14.6%. What's particularly notable is the consistency of this growth. Double-digit increases in each of the last four fiscal years. It's not just a flash in the pan, it's a consistent upward trajectory. And this growth is a healthy blend of both organic expansion, meaning new business won and retained from existing clients, growing their footprint naturally, and acquisitive growth, which comes from buying other companies. In 2024, for example, their total revenue increased by 12.9%, and a significant 10.4 percentage points of that came from organic growth. That's strong organic growth.
Oh, over 10% organic is solid.
Very solid. Similarly, in 2023, total revenue grew 19.1%, with 10.2% derived organically. This ability to generate robust organic growth is something management explicitly calls the lifeblood of our firm. And it's a critical indicator of the underlying health of the business and its ability to consistently win and retain clients without simply relying on M&A to fuel growth.
And how did the different segments contribute to this impressive growth trajectory? Was it pretty broad-based, or was it driven by just one or two areas pulling all the weight?
It was largely broad-based, which really speaks to the strength of their diversified model and that decentralized structure we keep coming back to. In 2023, all four of their segments at the time posted double-digit revenue growth. Everyone was firing. In 2024, even under the new three-segment structure, the program segment was a particularly strong performer, delivering that exceptional 22.4% organic revenue growth rate we mentioned earlier.
Right, the specialized stuff really flew.
Exactly. This indicates that their specialized niche businesses are really thriving and driving significant internal expansion, even as their larger retail segment maintains consistent, if sometimes slower, growth.
Growth is great, of course. But is it profitable growth? That's the key question. How do their margins look compared to the industry? And what does that tell us about their operational efficiency and their ability to integrate acquisitions without, you know, diluting profitability?
This is where Brown & Brown really shines, honestly. And it's a core reason for their premium valuation in the market. A key tenet of their investment case is their consistent focus on profitable growth. And that's clearly evident in their industry-leading and, importantly, expanding adjusted EBITDAC margins.
Okay, adjusted EBITDAC. Break that down quickly.
Sure. It's a crucial non-GAAP metric. It gives a clearer picture of their core recurring operating profitability by stripping out non-cash items like depreciation and amortization, D&A, and also the often variable non-operational impact of acquisition earnouts. Earnouts are those contingent payments made to sellers based on the acquired company's future performance. They can fluctuate a lot and kind of muddy the operational picture.
Got it. So it's a cleaner look at operations.
Exactly. By removing them, we see the true operating efficiency. And their adjusted EBITDAC margin expanded by 120 basis points in 2023 to 33.9%. Then it expanded by another 130 basis points in 2024 to an impressive 35.2%.
35% margins. That's very healthy.
Very healthy. This consistent margin expansion in a highly competitive industry highlights their strong operational discipline, effective expense management, and their ability to integrate acquisitions in a way that actually adds to profitability rather than diluting it. They buy well and integrate well. Their returns on capital are also robust, indicating efficient use of their assets to generate profits. Their return on invested capital, or ROIC, has averaged 10.0% over the 2020-2024 period, reaching 10.5% in 2024. Return on equity, or ROE, stood at a healthy 15.1% in the most recent reporting period. Now, it's worth noting something here. For a capital-light business like theirs, ROIC can sometimes appear lower than the true economic returns. Why? Because their balance sheet carries a substantial and growing goodwill balance.
Goodwill from all the acquisitions.
Precisely. It reached $8.37 billion as of Q2 2025. This goodwill represents the value of intangible assets like client relationships, brand, human capital, things you acquire but can't physically touch. This inflates the denominator, the invested capital part of the ROIC calculation, potentially understating the efficiency of their actual capital deployment in a purely accounting sense.
So the real returns might be even better.
Potentially, yes. Given their strong ability to convert revenue into free cash flow, the actual cash-on-cash returns from their M&A strategy are likely quite strong.
Okay. And one of the benefits of a capital-light model, as you mentioned earlier, is often incredibly strong cash flow. Is that true for Brown & Brown? And how strong was their balance sheet before this massive accession deal fundamentally changes their financial picture?
Yes, absolutely. Brown & Brown is a prodigious generator of cash. It's a significant competitive advantage and a real testament to their business model. Their cash flow from operations, or CFO, has shown a strong upward trajectory. It exceeded $1 billion in 2023 and grew to nearly $1.2 billion in 2024. This robust operating cash flow consistently converts into strong free cash flow, or FCF, which reached $1.16 billion in 2024. That's a 10.9% increase over the prior year. This powerful cash generation is the engine that funds their entire capital allocation strategy, from internal investments to acquisitions and shareholder returns, often without needing to constantly tap external capital markets. Historically, Brown & Brown has maintained a pretty conservative balance sheet. Management has a stated strategy of actively paying down floating rate debt after large finance acquisitions to quickly restore financial flexibility. As of June 30th, 2025, they actually reported a temporary net cash position of $1.12 billion.
Yeah, cash. Wow.
Yeah, it was a unique situation, though. It reflected the proceeds from their capital raise in anticipation of the Accession acquisition closing, which happened on August 1st. It highlights their careful planning, but it was definitely a fleeting moment of cash surplus.
Right, because the Accession deal, being so monumental, is definitely going to change that leverage profile, isn't it? This temporary net cash position won't last. The balance sheet will look very, very different.
That's exactly right. The $9.825 billion acquisition will materially increase their debt levels. There's no way around that. And the post-acquisition leverage profile will be a critical area for investors to monitor going forward. Absolutely critical. While their history suggests they will work diligently to pay this down using their strong free cash flow, the initial impact on their balance sheet will be significant. It will reduce their immediate financial flexibility and raise their risk profile, at least temporarily. It's a calculated risk, certainly, but for a huge strategic prize.
Okay, so with all this historical success and impressive cash generation, what's their playbook for continued growth? Seems like they really have two main engines driving everything. But the Accession deal suggests one of those engines just got a serious turbocharger fitted.
Huh. Yeah, you've hit on it precisely. Brown & Brown's growth strategy is built on a clear and consistent dual-pronged approach that balances both internal and external initiatives. First, there's organic growth. This is prioritized by the company as the lifeblood of our firm, as management always puts it. It's driven by a combination of winning new clients, maintaining incredibly high retention rates on existing business, I mean, clients often stay for decades cross-selling additional services to current clients, and naturally benefiting from rising insurance premium rates and client exposure unit growth across the market. This is the fundamental day-to-day engine of the business. The second engine is acquisitive growth. Mergers and acquisitions are not an episodic event for Brown & Brown. They are a core competency and a continuous element of their strategy. They don't just do deals, they are deal makers. They have a long and highly successful history as a disciplined consolidator in the fragmented insurance brokerage industry. To give you a sense of scale again, in 2024 alone, the company completed 32 acquisitions. 32, which represented approximately $174 million in annualized revenue.
That's like buying a decent-sized company every couple of weeks.
Pretty much. And this followed a similar pace in 2023, where they completed 33 acquisitions for about $162 million in revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a relentless and strategic pursuit of growth through M&A, consistently adding new capabilities and geographic reach.
Right. M&A is clearly a huge part of their story, but they emphasize cultural fit so strongly. What's their philosophy when it comes to acquiring other companies, especially if financial attractiveness isn't the only driver? And how do they really assess that elusive cultural fit? It sounds kind of subjective.
It does sound subjective, but their M&A approach is indeed highly disciplined and very relationship-driven, with a really specific primary filter, cultural alignment. Management has consistently emphasized that they absolutely will not pursue a deal, regardless of how financially attractive it might appear on paper, if the target company doesn't fit within Brown & Brown's decentralized, entrepreneurial, and team-oriented culture.
They'll walk away even if the numbers look great.
They say they will, and their track record seems to support that. This focus on cultural fit is seen as the absolute key to successful integration, which in turn ensures the long-term retention of both the talent and the clients from those acquired firms. They understand that in a service business like this, people and relationships are the core assets you're buying. Assessing cultural fit isn't just a checkbox exercise, though. It's a deep dive into the target's operating philosophy, their leadership style, how their employees interact. It involves extensive due diligence beyond the financials management interviews, understanding compensation structures, even informal meetings to gauge interpersonal dynamics. You know, we've probably all heard stories of deals where the financials were perfect, but the cultural handshake just didn't happen. It's like trying to make two completely different types of engines run off the same fuel. Doesn't work. Brown & Brown, I think, prides itself on being able to gently retune, not just replace, those acquired engines. That's a critical difference, and it seems to have served them incredibly well, preventing the kind of post-merger talent exodus that can plague other firms.
Okay, but the Accession acquisition, nearly $10 billion, a roll-up of over 190 other firms, that's an entirely different beast than their usual tuck-in deals. Completely different scale. This shift from prolific tuck-in acquisitions to a mega deal like Accession is monumental. Does this new whale hunting strategy inherently change the tuck-in playbook? Or could it potentially even create a kind of two-speed M&A machine within Brown & Brown that needs careful management?
You're right to highlight the difference. It's a profound strategic evolution, no doubt about it. The Accession deal is indeed an order of magnitude larger than any previous deal they've undertaken. Truly transformative. This move signals a fundamental shift in the company's M&A aperture. While they will certainly continue with a high volume of those bolt-on, tuck-in acquisitions, which they're incredibly good at, it's in their DNA. They are now clearly including large, leverage-intensive whale transactions that are designed to fundamentally alter their competitive positioning in the industry. They're playing a bigger game now, and this does create a new set of challenges, almost a two-speed M&A machine, as you put it. The skills required to integrate a small 10-person agency are vastly different from those needed to integrate a $1.7 billion revenue entity composed of 190 previous acquisitions.
Totally different league.
Totally different. It requires different internal teams, different project management capabilities, a different level of executive bandwidth and focus. While management has stressed the strong cultural alignment they believe exists with Accession, the sheer scale of this integration introduces a new, elevated level of execution risk, big time. The success of this deal will require management to demonstrate proficiency, not just as excellent operators of their existing business, but as highly capable integrators of massive, complex organizations. It also means they'll be stewards of a much more significantly levered balance sheet, at least temporarily. And we're also seeing this strategic evolution maybe reflected in their international operations too, with potential shift towards a smaller number of larger deals in Europe, as exemplified by their Quintes acquisition in the Netherlands. So this trend might not be just a one-off.
Okay. With all this robust cash generation and continuous M&A, both big and small now, how does Brown & Brown decide where to put its money? What's their disciplined capital allocation framework? And how does this massive accession deal fit into that long-term philosophy?
They operate with a very clear and disciplined hierarchy for capital allocation, really designed to maximize long-term shareholder value. The first priority is always internal investment. Always. This means reinvesting directly back into the business to drive organic growth. That includes hiring new producers, investing in cutting-edge technology and innovation, expanding the capabilities of their existing teams, basically, the foundational elements that fuel their lifeblood. The second priority is strategic M&A, pursuing high-quality acquisitions that meet their strict cultural and financial criteria. This is the primary use of any excess capital generated. The Accession deal, despite its enormous scale, fits into this bucket as a strategic, hopefully high-quality acquisition, albeit one that really pushes the boundaries of their historical definition of strategic.
Stretches the definition a bit, maybe.
Maybe. Finally, the third component is shareholder returns. This includes both dividends and opportunistic share repurchases. Their commitment to shareholder returns is evident in their status as an S&P 500 dividend aristocrat, having increased their dividend for 31 consecutive years now. In 2024, they returned about $154 million to shareholders in dividends. Share repurchases are used more opportunistically, often just to offset dilution from employee stock-based compensation plans, not huge buybacks typically. And a crucial element underpinning this entire framework is their commitment to maintaining a conservative balance sheet over the long term. They have a well-established pattern of rapidly paying down debt after large acquisitions using their strong free cash flow. They take on leverage, yes,
yeah,
but then they aggressively work to delever.
Right. No business operates in a vacuum, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the insurance market itself is highly cyclical. Brown & Brown has navigated many cycles before, but what are the current dynamics they're facing right now in the P&C, property and casualty market? How are these cycles creating both challenges and maybe some opportunities for them?
You're absolutely right. The P&C insurance market is in a significant state of flux currently, which means it's a bit of a mixed bag for brokers like Brown & Brown. After several years of what's known as a hard market, characterized by broad-based premium rate increases and tighter capacity from insurers' conditions, have become much more bifurcated. It's split. On one hand, we're seeing softening commercial property rates. This trend began in 2024 and has definitely continued into 2025. Increased capacity from reinsurers and maybe some new market entrants has led to heightened competition and critically downward pressure on rates.
Prices are coming down for property insurance.
For commercial property, yes. In their Q2 2025 earnings call, management noted that excess and surplus property rates were down anywhere from 15% to 30%. That's a big drop. This directly creates a headwind to organic revenue growth, as brokers earn commissions as a percentage of these lower premiums.
Less premium means less commission.
Exactly. We saw this impact in the retail segment's 3.0% organic growth in Q2 2025, which was below their own expectations. Management has explicitly guided investors to factor in this continued rate deceleration for the rest of the year. It just means they have to work harder, write more business to maintain their commission base. On the other hand, though, casualty lines, things like commercial auto, general liability, and umbrella excess liability remain firm. They're continuing to see rate increases. Insurers are still pushing for rate increases of maybe 5% to 20% in these areas.
Why have you been in this?
It's largely to combat the effects of what's called social inflation, basically. Rising litigation costs and larger jury awards, along with adverse loss development trends that have been impacting insurer profitability in those lines for years. So while commercial property is softening, casualty is hardening. This provides a partial but often incomplete offset to the headwinds in other areas. It's like sailing with a strong wind on one side of the boat and a weak one or even a headwind on the other makes steering tricky.
Yeah, complex picture. Beyond the specifics of the insurance cycle, what's the general macroeconomic backdrop? How does that broader environment affect Brown & Brown's business and maybe its clients' willingness to invest in comprehensive coverage?
The broader macroeconomic environment is always a factor, yeah. It influences everything from client spending decisions to the investment income Brown & Brown earns. While inflation has moderated somewhat from its recent peaks, its cumulative impact on asset replacement costs continues to be a focus for insurance underwriters. If it costs significantly more to rebuild a damaged property now, then disciplined pricing is needed to cover that cost, which can actually support rates in some areas. The higher interest rate environment, too, has a mixed effect. On the plus side, it generally boosts the investment income Brown & Brown earns on its substantial cash balances, its float. They get better returns.
Good for their cash pile.
Right. But it also increases the cost of debt for its M&A activities, including the big accession deal, which will be financed with a significant debt component. Makes borrowing more expensive. In their Q2 2025 earnings call, management characterized the economic outlook of their clients generally as cautiously optimistic. They noted that while some investment decisions might be getting delayed, the overall economy generally remains in a good place, providing a relatively stable foundation for demand for their services.
Okay, so the market is tricky, they're navigating these complex cycles, and they just made this absolutely massive acquisition. What are the immediate hands-on priorities for management right now, particularly for the next, say, 12 to 18 months, to ensure they successfully execute this monumental shift? What's top of the list?
The most significant near-term challenge, and frankly, catalyst for Brown & Brown, is unequivocally the successful integration of Accession Risk Management Group. That transaction officially closed on August 1st, 2025, so it's happening right now. This raises that important question for their execution. The immediate priorities are multifaceted and incredibly demanding. They must undertake the complex task of merging the distinct cultures of the two organizations, or maybe the many cultures within Accession.
Right, the 190-plus firms.
Exactly. They have to execute the operational combination of Brown & Brown's programs and wholesale segments with Accession's platforms to form that new, formidable specialty distribution segment. That's a huge structural change. And they need to begin the rigorous process of realizing the substantial revenue and cost synergies that were a key part of the deal's rationale. They have to prove the deal makes financial sense. This isn't just about shuffling organizational charts. It's about seamlessly blending thousands of people, different systems, different client relationships. It's huge. And beyond this monumental domestic integration, the company is also executing that strategic evolution in its international operations. Following the 2024 Quintes acquisition in the Netherlands, their UK leadership has signaled a shift in their European M&A strategy towards a smaller number of larger deals rather than a high volume of small ones. They're integrating those under a one retail strategic initiative for the region. So yeah, it's a period of intense transformation on multiple fronts simultaneously.
Okay, let's talk valuation. How does the market actually value Brown & Brown? What do the current multiples tell us? And why does a company like this, despite being smaller than the big three, often command a premium compared to some of its peers? What justifies that confidence from investors?
Right, valuation. As of mid-2025, Brown & Brown trades at a trailing 12-month, or TTM, PE ratio of approximately 27.4x. Its forward PE multiple, looking ahead, is in the range of 21x to 23x. And its TTM price-to-sales ratio stands at about 5.5x.
But pretty healthy multiples.
Definitely healthy. If we compare this to its direct peer group, Brown & Brown's valuation is robust. Its forward PE multiple is generally higher than that of, say, Willis Towers Watson. It often trades in a similar range to Aon and Arthur J. Gallagher. It typically trades at a discount to the largest industry leader, Marsh McLennan, which kind of reflects that scale difference we talked about. Their forward dividend yield of approximately 0.6% is notably lower than larger peers.
Yeah, not a big yield stock.
No, and that's consistent with their capital allocation strategy that prioritizes reinvestment in high return growth, both organic and through M&A over higher immediate shareholder payouts. They're basically signaling to the market, we think we can generate better returns for you by reinvesting this cash.
Mm.
Now, the market's willingness to accord Brown & Brown a premium valuation seems pretty well supported by its fundamental performance over time. The company's growth has consistently outpaced its peer group. An analysis from May 2024 highlighted that Brown & Brown's three-year revenue CAGR of 16.7% and its three-year EPS CAGR of 20.7% were actually the highest among its large-cap peers.
Best-in-class growth.
Exactly. This superior growth, combined with its consistent track record of margin expansion and strong returns on capital, are the hallmarks of a high-quality compounder. And those types of companies typically command a higher multiple in the market. Investors are willing to pay more for consistent high-quality growth.
Okay. So, with all these factors at play, the strong track record, the premium valuation, but now this massive deal, what's the potential future trajectory for its valuation? What could make it go up or down from here? Especially considering the Accession acquisition and the enormous expectations tied to it. Is there room for it to go higher, or is the risk skewed downwards now?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It raises this important point about potential multiple re-rating, which is intrinsically linked to the execution of the Accession acquisition. It really hinges on that. In a bull case scenario, the one where things go well, leading to multiple expansion, Well, a successful and seamless integration of Accession that either delivers or maybe even exceeds the anticipated financial and strategic benefits could serve as a powerful catalyst. If the company can demonstrate accelerated organic growth from its newly formed specialty distribution powerhouse, if they successfully achieve their deleveraging targets faster than expected, and really prove that the power of WE can truly scale this significantly.
If they pull it off.
If they pull it off, the market may re-rate the stock closer to the premium multiples commanded by industry leaders like Marsh McLennan. This would signify that they've successfully transitioned to a new league of competitive power. Conversely, in a bear case scenario, the one leading to multiple contraction, well, any significant stumbles in the integration process could trigger that. Things like cultural clashes leading to significant talent attrition, a failure to realize the projected synergies, or maybe a prolonged period of suppressed organic growth due to market headwinds or integration disruption.
If it goes wrong.
If it goes wrong, the market would likely reevaluate. They'd question the premium paid for the acquisition and the company's elevated leverage profile. That could potentially re-rate the stock toward the lower end of its peer group valuation range. This would signal that the market believes the growth and profitability gains were not worth the increased risk taken on. So the execution risk directly impacts the valuation potential.
Makes sense. Every investment has risks, and Brown, despite its strong track record, is obviously no exception, especially now with this massive deal. What are the key risks you think people should be aware of if they're looking at this company, particularly those magnified by this unprecedented acquisition?
Yeah, it's crucial to have a clear-eyed assessment of the risks, especially now. We can probably categorize them into three main areas. First, business and industry risks. P&C market cyclicality. As we just discussed, soft markets directly hurt commission-based revenue. The current softening in commercial property is a live example right now, demonstrating how external market forces can impact their top line.
Something they can't control.
Exactly. Intense competition. They operate in a highly competitive market against both larger global brokers and nimble specialists that can always pressure margins and growth. The barbell structure means competition comes from all sides. Disintermediation risk. This is a longer-term structural threat, the risk of clients bypassing brokers for direct or maybe insurtech solutions. While commercial insurance complexity offers a strong defense right now, it's a persistent threat that technology continually evolves. Regulatory and legal risks. As a global firm, they face complex, evolving regulations everywhere on disclosure, data privacy, cybersecurity, and they're always exposed to errors and omissions, E&O, litigation if something goes wrong with advice or placement. One big misstep can have significant financial and reputational consequences. Second area, and this is the big one right now, execution and M&A risks. These are significantly amplified by Accession. Accession integration risk. This is unequivocally the most significant and immediate risk. Full stop. Failure to effectively integrate operations, technology, and cultures could destroy substantial shareholder value. How? Through talent loss, client loss, missed synergies, operational disruption. It's the ultimate test of their M&A prowess.
The big one.
The big one. Cultural dilution. Related to that, rapid growth and the massive influx from Accession itself, a roll-up of 190 firms, remember, could compromise Brown & Brown's unique entrepreneurial culture. That could harm productivity and innovation long-term. Maintaining the power of we across such a vast, newly merged organization is a monumental task. M&A overpayment risk. Generally, the highly competitive M&A market, especially with private equity pushing prices up, increases the risk of overpaying for acquisitions. That makes it harder to generate attractive returns and puts pressure on future performance to justify the price paid. Did they pay too much for Accession? Time will tell. And finally, the third category, financial risks. Increased financial leverage. The Accession financing will materially increase debt, no question. This reduces financial flexibility in the near term and increases vulnerability to economic downturns or unexpected market shocks. This leverage level will be closely watched by everyone. Interest rate sensitivity. A significant portion of their debt is likely floating rate. So sustained high interest rates would increase their debt service costs, reducing net income and cash flow available for other things, like paying down that debt rapidly.
A potential double whammy there.
Could be. Goodwill impairment. Their balance sheet holds substantial goodwill now, well over $8 billion post-accession, probably much more. If an acquired business underperforms significantly, it could lead to non-cash impairment charges, hitting reported earnings, and potentially signaling to the market that the acquisition didn't live up to its promise. #outro perk.
Wow. What a journey we've been on today. We've gone from really understanding Brown's unique decentralized model and its impressive track record of consistent growth and dividend increases, all the way to this monumental Accession acquisition that is fundamentally reshaping its future and positioning it as a potential top-tier player, especially in specialty insurance. It's a truly fascinating case study in strategic evolution, isn't it?
Yeah,
it really is. And just to summarize, the core investment merits for Brown & Brown remain strong. Its resilient, high-margin business model, a proven dual-pronged growth strategy, that unique empowering culture we discussed, and disciplined capital allocation. Crucially, the Accession deal strategically repositions them in those high-growth specialty markets, offering significant potential upside. However, the investment concerns are equally significant right now and bear close watching. That transformational M&A integration risk is absolutely paramount. Organic growth faces headwinds from the P&C cycle, their financial leverage will be elevated for a while, and they operate in an intensely competitive landscape. It's definitely a story with both high potential and significant challenge ahead.
So what does this all mean for you, the curious learner, the informed investor who wants to keep an eye on this fascinating story? How can you continue to track this bold bet that Brown & Brown has made? How can you measure its success or struggle in the coming years? What should you watch?
Yeah, good question. You'll want to keep a close watch on several key metrics and strategic narratives going forward. First, monitor organic revenue growth. Pay particular attention to the performance of the newly formed specialty distribution segment, but also any stabilization or reacceleration in the retail segment. This tells you if the underlying business is truly thriving post-deal. Second, track their adjusted EBITDAC margin. You're looking for continued expansion ideally, and clear evidence of synergy realization from the Accession integration, are they actually making the combined entity more profitable? Third, follow M&A integration progress. Any qualitative or quantitative updates from management on synergies, client retention rates, employee retention rates, those will be critical indicators of whether the cultural and operational blend is actually working smoothly. Listen to those earnings calls.
The qualitative stuff matters here too.
Hugely. Fourth, assess cash flow conversion and deleveraging the pace of debt repayment will be crucial in restoring their balance sheet flexibility and reducing financial risk. How quickly can they pay down that big chunk of debt? And finally, keep an eye on return on invested capital, ROIC, over the longer term. That will be the ultimate measure of the success of their significant capital deployment into the Accession acquisition. Was it truly an accretive use of capital? Did it generate good returns?
Brown & Brown has always built its success on a foundation of local autonomy and disciplined tuck-in growth, steadily expanding its footprint one relationship at a time. The Accession deal represents a huge bet that this proven model can not only scale to an unprecedented degree, but actually thrive in the global whale game, competing directly with the biggest names in the industry. The question for you to ponder as you consider the future of this company is this: can the power of WE truly integrate over 190 past acquisitions and thousands of new professionals without losing the very essence, that unique culture that made it a dividend aristocrat in the first place? It's a true test of culture meeting scale, and the coming years will be absolutely fascinating to watch as this unique story unfolds.